Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why opioid overdoses are up in Arizona, even as they drop in most other states. And we visit a local coffee house that's staying open late for fasting Muslims during Ramadan. But first, one of the last wild open spaces along the U.S.-Mexico border is being blown up by crews who are building the president's border wall at a furious pace. It's in Coronado National Monument in southeastern Arizona, funded by more than $46 billion in federal dollars from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed through Congress last year. During President Trump's first term, areas like these, mountainous, environmentally sensitive, were left out of the campaign to build a border wall, but not anymore. And our first guest this morning got a firsthand look at the demolition that's taking place and its environmental stakes. Nick Miroff is a staff writer at The Atlantic who covers immigration, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Nick. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So, you were there watching some of this demolition taking place. Just tell us first, you know, what you saw.
Yeah, so I was watching from an overlook at Coronado National Memorial, as you say, right along the U.S.-Mexico border, where the Trump administration's crews are blowing up parts of national parkland to sort of smooth out the path for the construction of the border wall. And this is part of a segment that goes right through the middle of the San Rafael Valley in southern Arizona. And this is, as you said, one of the last open rangelands in this part of really along the entire U.S.-Mexico border, and was one of those kind of remote and sensitive areas that was, you know, didn't get touched during his first administration. But now that, you know, the administration has all this money to spend, it is building 30-foot, you know, black painted border wall right through the middle of this area.
Right. How many miles are they planning on building in this area?
So this segment is about 30 miles. It goes from the Huachuca Mountains at Coronado National Memorial and connects all the way over through the Patagonia Mountains across the San Rafael Valley. And then, you know, that's going to connect on the other side with the segments that are east of Nogales.
Right. And you mentioned it's painted black. Why is that?
The president has insisted that the border wall be painted black because he thinks it's going to be hotter to the touch and that he likes the way it looked. It was never part of the Border Patrol initial plan for the barrier. It adds a lot of maintenance costs. It doesn't actually increase the temperature of the steel. What I've observed over the years is almost as soon as they put it out there in the desert, it starts to peel.
Mm. So let's talk about where this is a little bit more. You mentioned it's really remote. Is this a place where we have traditionally seen a lot of border crossings?
No, this is one of these areas that was never a priority for the Border Patrol in terms of construction because it doesn't have a lot of drug smuggling activity or migrants crossing. But part of that is because Highway 2 on the Mexican side of the border, which, you know, is the main kind of east-west corridor in northern Mexico, it isn't anywhere near the San Rafael Valley. It goes far south of the border there. And so there aren't a lot of crossings there. There has not been a big need for, a heavy enforcement presence. And since CBP installed the camera towers years ago, it's been pretty quiet.
Right, right. You write about just how much the kind of reasoning from the Trump administration has changed here. Like during the president's first term, areas like these were left alone for reasons like that. Why do they say they're building this now?
Well, you can remember Trump's first Homeland Security Secretary in his first term, John Kelly, used to say, we don't need a border wall from sea to shining sea.
Right.
And there were restraints on the kind of ambitions of the project. Some of them were financial restraints, but they were also some common sense restraints on the need to actually try to build through these very steep, rugged, mountainous areas where few people try to cross. But all of that thinking is now out the window because the administration has all this money to spend, $46 billion. And so, you know, the sky is the limit, and they're just gonna blast their way right through these remote areas in order to complete the president's vision for a massive, you know, border wall.
Right. And this is just a small part of that big vision, right? So you talk about some of the environmental impacts. There are plans to even go through places like the Tanaa'atham Reservation, which sits along the border, which has been exempt in the past. This is a national memorial, as we mentioned. What about environmental protection laws?
Those have been waived by the administration. There's really no there's no restraints that are on, you know, Customs and Border Protection to issue these contracts, to hire these companies to dynamite the land and build the structure. They're you know, in a place like the San Rafael Valley, where water is you know, a lifeblood and is so crucial to not only the ranchers but also the wildlife in this area. They're pumping groundwater at a furious pace out of this aquifer in order to mix concrete to build the wall. And so, you know, these areas are going to be increasingly stressed because the water is being used for border wall construction.
There are lawsuits from environmental groups over this. You talk about how this area is where jaguars have been spotted, kind of returning to the region. I want to ask you before I let you go about some time you spent with one of these environmental folks along the border who has put cameras along the border wall, sort of documenting where wildlife is being blocked. And he also documented a place where people were not being blocked, but environmental, but wildlife were.
Yeah, I'll try to describe this quickly, but we went out to check some border wall. I'm sorry, checked some trail cameras that have been set up at some openings. They're called floodgates, and they're during monsoon season, they're left open by the border patrol so that the border wall doesn't get knocked down by all the debris coming down the washes, you know, during the monsoons. And so he has a camera set up at one of these and periodically checks to see. And what we saw was a mountain lion approaching the border wall, finding its path blocked, and, you know, looking very confused by this structure suddenly cutting off its habitat. And on the same camera, not long after, we saw an image of four men wearing camouflage, rappelling down, lowering themselves on ropes. And so here you have a border wall not stopping the people that it was designed to stop, but blocking the path of large, you know, species like mountain lions.
Quite a contrast. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Nick Miroff, staff writer at The Atlantic, joining us. Nick, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
In recent years, there has been, for once, good news about opioid overdoses in the U.S. They were going down all over the place by a lot.
Fentanyl and other street drugs killed more than 230,000 people under the age of 35 in the U.S. over the last decade. But new federal data shows drug deaths among young people are plummeting at an unprecedented rate.
Dr. Darian is here with us, and some positive numbers to talk about
Great
today
numbers, yeah.
With drug overdoses.
They fell by more than 17%. So this is a
And some encouraging news tonight in the long battle against opioid abuse in North Carolina.
Overdose deaths are down significantly. Thanks.
Overdose deaths in Memphis and Shelby County are trending down.
Overdose deaths are dropping in Alabama and across the nation. We're talking a significant decline.
But now a new report from the CDC's National Vital Statistics System showed that this is still true for most states. Almost everywhere, there were decreases in reported drug overdose deaths from 2024 to 2025 of more than 20%, but not here in Arizona. In fact, only five states saw increases in deaths in that time, including us. Arizona reported the highest rise in overdose deaths by far at over 17%, almost the exact inverse of the national average. For addiction medicine doctor Matt Evans, it's been a roller coaster.
I was so happy that it was going down. My work seemed to be going well, and that's what the patients have been saying too, that things are getting more stable. I'm feeling like this treatment facility is helping me, and you have me on this medication, and I feel like I'm getting stable. And then, I don't know, it was, you know, the data says it's right at the beginning of 2025.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people were in a stress situation because there was, you know, a lot of things that were going on in the country. a lot of changes that were happening. But if it was all just due to some national issue, we would see that across the board nationally,
right,
higher overdose rates in every single state. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing decreases in most states. And then Arizona is this anomaly where we're seeing a sharp upward trend.
Dr. Evans is the medical director of addiction medicine for Circle the City, as well as director of addiction treatment services at New Hope Behavioral Health Center. His patients are often living on the streets, trying to stay clean. He told me there are a lot of reasons why Arizona is seeing deaths go up when everyone else is seeing them go down, from displacement to red tape. Tripti Chowdhury is a licensed trauma clinician and volunteer with the harm reduction group Shot in the Dark. And she told me it also has to do with what drugs are on the streets.
Well, I mean, one of the biggest things we're seeing is xylazine, which is a tranquilizer. And it's looking like a longer effect heroin high, right? Like people are not sure how to respond to it.
These kind of drugs are Narcan resistant, she said. So you can't use the opioid overdose reversal drug to save someone who's taken too much. Chowdhury is a former drug user herself who now works to help drug users stay safe and alive while using. She's particularly worried about a new parks ordinance from the city of Phoenix that will put restrictions on providing medical care, including some harm reduction work, in city parks.
It does put us at risk because now we're starting to ban. We're bringing back words that are very hostile.
Hmm.
This is the first step in the wrong direction, and that's what I'm scared of.
Sounds like you see this kind of policy at a local level as like the canary in the coal mine of what's to come.
Yeah, I do believe that overdose rates are going to be higher because we're restricting where we can go. When they're on their feet, on bikes, they're unhoused even in their cars, then we can't serve them.
For Dr. Evans, it's all of these things and more that's leading to this rise in overdose deaths here. I sat down with him in our studios recently to talk more about it all, and it's today's deep dive.
As far as what exactly is causing that, I've been talking with multiple people. I've talked with Arlene Mahoney. She's the harm reduction director of Southwest Recovery Alliance. She has stated that people are suffering from displacement, so they're having to go from one place to another. When that happens, not only are you having a hard time keeping up with your doctor, your addiction treatment facility, but you're having a hard time keeping up with your friends or even the person who you buy drugs from.
Hmm.
When that happens, people have less stability in their life. And when you have to change drug supply, you're at increased risk for an overdose.
Hmm.
So if you go from one person to another person, this person may have an opioid that is predictable in strength, quantity. The other person that you go to may have a higher potency opioid, or it may have xylazine in it, or it may have another drug that your body's not familiar with. So it's going to put you at increased risk for overdose. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of the times when people are getting displaced and they're going from one place to another, sometimes they're going through withdrawal for a period. And that happens if you go through with opioid withdrawal and then go back to your previous dose of opioid, you're far higher risk for an overdose.
What's leading to that displacement and that kind of disruption for folks?
Yeah, I think that as far as where people are going, you know, I do homeless health care. I work for Circle the City, and we're trying to meet people where they're at.
Yeah.
Not necessarily psychologically, not necessarily physically, but all of the above. Sometimes even, you know, from a mental health standpoint, we'll meet them wherever they're at. We'll refill their meds and try to get them that care that they need in the place that they're at.
Yeah.
But there's a million different reasons for why they may have been displaced. Maybe they were not allowed to stay at the city park that they were allowed to stay at for some period of time. Maybe they were sleeping in an alley and they can't stay there anymore. Maybe they were just released from jail or prison and they had a follow-up appointment that they missed and now they're back on the streets again. There's a lot of reasons for why they would be displaced, but it's happening and we're trying to help fill those gaps.
Hmm. I want to ask about the drugs themselves that folks are using and if that's changed. I've read a lot about how fentanyl now, especially in Arizona, seems to be appearing in a powder form, and that might be changing things, making it harder to maybe measure. But fentanyl is so deadly. Are we just seeing changes in the availability of these drugs that can lead so easily to overdoses?
Yeah, I think that that is definitely the case. When they were in pills, even the pills had different concentrations, but at least you could count them and be like, okay, I'm going to use two pills and not just like a unmeasured quantity of powder. Mm-hmm. I talked with some harm reduction folks and they said that we're seeing people fall out or have overdoses far more frequently when the dealers switched from pills to powders. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely harder to measure. The potency is definitely more variable. And we're finding not only fentanyl, ultrapotent fentanyl, xylazine, but there even are these even more ultrapotent opioids called nitazines that are being found in the drug supply. They're really hard to test for. So I don't have a lot of evidence as to how frequently they're showing up in the drug supply, but xylazine has been in certain pockets. And we do provide patients with xylazine test strips to test their fentanyl supply to make sure that they are at least not taking a sedative in addition to the fentanyl that they're using. Mm. So as the trends continue to evolve, there's this thing called the iron law of prohibition. And the iron law of prohibition is as long as we continue with the same approach of more and more severe penalties against people who use drugs, the drug supply is going to become more and more unsafe because whatever volume of powder, it could be the most potent, is going to be the one that's chosen because it's easier to transport. It's easier to get into the hands of dealers so you don't have a big, huge quantity of drugs. And that's more dangerous for the user because that tiny amount of drug can cause an overdose. Mm.
All right. We'll talk more about that and the policy reasons that might have led us here in just a moment. That is Dr. Matt Evans, Medical Director of Addiction Medicine for Circle the City, as well as Director of Addiction Treatment Services at New Hope Behavioral Health Center. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Let's return now to my deep dive conversation with Dr. Matt Evans about why overdose rates are up in Arizona, even as they drop nationwide. He's an addiction medicine doctor with Circle the City and New Hope Behavioral Health Center. So, Dr. Evans, is this a policy problem in your opinion? Like, from my reporting at least, like, it seems like we have done so much in the state in the last couple of years here in terms of harm reduction. Like, we've seen the widespread adoption of naloxone and Narcan and these things that can reverse an overdose being available pretty widely. We've seen legalized needle exchanges for folks so they can, you know, have access to clean needles. We've legalized fentanyl testing strips so folks know what is in the drug they're taking and don't overdose. What else needs to happen?
I think we need to make getting treatment easier, and we need to make it more available. I was looking at the numbers because you asked me to come on the show, and I was noticing some concerning trends when an OTP, like an opioid treatment program, were to close down because there wasn't enough funding or there weren't enough patients in that small county to support the need for an opioid treatment program. It is an investment. It's a lot of money, staff, counselors, peer support workers, doctors, nurses. Mm-hmm. But when they close down, you see the surge in overdose. Hmm. Methadone treatment, Suboxone treatment, they are medications that cause opioid tolerance. So when you have that in your system and you come across fentanyl, whether intentionally or unintentionally, you're often not going to have an overdose. So people who are on those treatments, 60% less likely to have an overdose if you're on methadone, 40+% less likely to have an overdose if you're on buprenorphine, or commonly known as Suboxone. So we need to somehow fix this bottleneck problem of patients having to see a doctor, having to see their counselor, having to see a case manager before they get their medicine. Sometimes when we open new OTPs in these rural locations, there's these, like, we can start the patients on treatment as long as they're seen by their doctor, counselor, and treatment team within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a state of emergency where we need to just put funding down and open these clinics at a much faster rate than we are. But my opioid treatment program that I work at on Fridays and see patients, it's the funding to get the staff that we need to take care of the patients is not there. Mm. So we're even, you know, thinking about expanding to different states because Unfortunately, the funding here in Arizona is not where it should be.
So it's a funding issue, a red tape issue, it sounds like, for you.
It is both a red tape and a funding issue. Yeah, it's extremely bureaucratic to operate an OTP. It's very, very difficult to, you know, make sure that you're dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's.
Mm-hmm.
We do a very good job at it. But a lot of these treatment providers that are operating at scale, like much bigger patient populations than I have, they have an impossible task to make sure that all these I's are dotted, all these T's are mm-hmm. crossed, to make sure that their treatment facility is in compliance. And then when they're not in compliance, you know, sometimes they get shut down. And then that's going to make the problem worse because the patients don't have access to the medicine that saves their life.
So you were talking before about the drug supply and the dealers who people can see to get their drugs. And, you know, you're kind of operating under the assumption that people who use drugs are going to use drugs, and we have to kind of meet them where they are before you can try to get them to stop using drugs, right? But I wonder, like, those suppliers, that drug supply, those dealers, like, that's all illegal stuff. And you'll hear lots of folks say, prosecutors in particular, that we just need, maybe among other things, but we also need harsher sentencing for drug traffickers, harsher penalties so that these people who are supplying the drugs to the people who want them can't do it anymore.
Yeah, I disagree. I read this amazing article by Susan Austerman. She's incredible. She's somebody who addiction has affected her life. I'll leave it at that. And she basically said that you cannot double down on the same policies that have caused the situation that we're in.
Hmm.
The more that we criminalize, the more that we penalize, the more that we go to war, these are all things that are going to cause trauma and hurt and suffering in people's lives. And that's the same reason why people use drugs to feel better. And it's not the right choice. It's not going to make you feel better. But it's what human beings have been doing since time immemorial. Mao Zedong tried to eliminate opiate users with mass murder, incarceration, and they still have a problem. There's no way that we can criminalize, dehumanize, or end life in a way that's going to end this problem. So we need to meet people where they're at, give them the treatments that we know work, and then over time, as they improve, as they're seeing our counselors, as they're processing their trauma, and as they're trying to untangle their life, if they're ready, we taper them down slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is an impossible task to just tell somebody, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, stop using drugs. If you've ever been in the situation of being on a chronic opioid, it is the most difficult thing I've heard of. If you hear people describe opioid withdrawals, it is not anything you ever want to go through.
Right. So let me end on that note, that kind of human note, right? Like, I think we hear these statistics a lot. People are aware that overdoses happen and that people use drugs. But when you know, have a stat out there, like 17% increase in overdoses in the state, what does that look like for real people on the ground? Like, how is it affecting people's lives? Are people scared?
Yes, people are terrified. And it hurts me, as not to bring it back to myself, as a treatment provider, because I have a lot of great tools. I have these tools, these treatment medications, these even long-acting injectables that we can give to patients that cover them for a whole month, and nobody's going to steal their medicine. You know, they're not going to lose it. And then we have this horrible time with getting them the medication that they need. There's still prior authorization requirements by the insurance companies, and the pharmacy and me work together to get the patient their medicine. But sometimes it's too late. They're leaving treatment. They haven't got their medication. Then I have to talk with the kid's mother about how our system has failed them.
Hmm.
And it shouldn't be this way. And we are all working together to change things, but we're in a crisis. And whatever we need to do, remove those prior authorization requirements, hire more peer support workers, allow addiction patients to be peer support workers to help us get out of this crisis, we need to do now.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Dr. Matt Evans, Medical Director of Addiction Medicine for Circle the City, as well as Director of Addiction Treatment Services at New Hope Behavioral Health Center. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the story of a touring blues rock and roll pianist who became known as the Klan Whisperer.
At that age of 10, I formed a question in my mind, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? So, you know, when I sat there with this Klansman, it didn't dawn on me right in the moment that this is the person I need to talk to.
How Daryl Davis befriended and inadvertently deprogrammed members of the KKK. But first, Arizona gets less money than it needs to cool residents' homes from the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. That's according to a new report on the federal program. The data show that broadly, colder weather states tend to get more money to cover heating costs than do warmer weather ones to pay for AC. According to the data, Arizona has one of the biggest disparities in the country between the amount low-income households spend on home energy and the amount of federal help they get. And this is happening as the Trump administration fired everyone working in the office that manages LIHEAP last year. Ashley Ward is the director of Heat Policy Innovation Hub at Duke University, which compiled the report. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about this data and efforts to bring parity to the funding. And they started with some of her key takeaways from the report.
The main key takeaway is that warm weather states have systematically received less funding relative to their need than cold weather states with the current LIHEAP formulation. And this is important because LIHEAP was originally established primarily to supplement heating in cold weather states. And unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of movement on how LIHEAP is funded in nearly 20 years, actually, even though the population has grown and need has grown. LIHEAP remains the most significant, largest federal government program designed to address energy affordability that we have. And so far, it has not only been underfunded, but systematically has underfunded cooling. And we're seeing every year this become a greater and greater demand.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it seems as though more and more parts of the country are starting to deal with extreme heat. Obviously, you know, here in Phoenix, we've been dealing with this for many, many years, but there are parts of the country that have not dealt with extreme heat before that are starting to. Does that make it maybe more important or maybe even more likely that the LIHEAP formula gets adjusted somewhat to deal with heat?
Yes. I mean, you know, at the same time that we're seeing what you're pointing out, which is more people being exposed to higher temperatures than we've had in the past, we are also seeing, even in those areas that have historically been warm, we are reaching limits of what we call safe fan use indoors. And this is certainly the case in Arizona. I'm sure you're aware of this, is that there is a certain threshold at which it is no longer safe to not have air conditioning in your home. And so in those cases, particularly in those cases, especially in those cases, we need people to have access to affordable cooling. But you take that as happening certainly across the Sun Belt and particularly in the southwest side of the Sun Belt. But as you just mentioned, all over the country, we're seeing higher temperatures. And even in areas that haven't historically been as hot as, say, below the Sun Belt. I mean, we see what's happened in Oregon with the heat dome, for example. Mm-hmm. But we see happening all over the country, people who, you know, have not typically had to deal with this issue are starting to deal with it. And in many cases, they don't have air conditioning in their home, or the air conditioning that they have is insufficient to adequately cool. So programs like LIHEAP are critical because they pay for heating and cooling, but they also pay for things like weatherization, which is also important.
At the same time, I mean, we're also seeing major winter storms. I mean, it kind of seems like it raises the question, is the pie itself big enough? Is there enough money to really go around to help, you know, places that are dealing with extreme heat now deal with that, but also at the same time not leave out people who are in places where it's very, very cold?
Oh, absolutely. The pie is currently not big enough. Currently, if you think about the way it's measured, right? So the Light Heat program was designed to measure energy expenditures, LIHE, low income housing energy expenditures. So that's need, basically. So the need is calculated on a state by state basis. And right now, nationally, LIHEAP only actually provides funds to cover 20% of eligible population. So it is critically and systemically underfunded. That is true. So the pie is not big enough. What's also happening, though, is even within that limited pie, a majority of those funds, something like 80% of those funds, goes toward heating and not cooling. And we've seen over recent years that the biggest trend in increased use is actually a need for cooling assistance.
Well, and when you talk about imbalance, it looked like, based on your report, that Arizona was either at or very close to the top of the list in terms of states where residents need help and aren't getting it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. That's true. So what we have done is, you know, and I also want to just point out, there have been periods where we have increased LIHEAP allocation, like, for example, recently during COVID, and then during the 2008 financial crisis, we increased allocations to LIHEAP. So there have been points in time where we have temporarily increased how much money we put into LIHEAP, but then it goes back to that original formula. So the two senators from Arizona have proposed a new kind of formula in the LIHEAP Parity Act, which is what we were testing in this report. And that formula is asking to recalculate LIHEAP that makes it more in line with directly tied to energy burdens, which is the intent of the program. Now, when you do that, it does, of course, increase the budget, overall budget allocation that's needed. But I just point out that there have been moments where we have increased the budget and we roll it back and out of those times of need. And I know that the sticker shock, you know, of the increased investment might be a disincentive for people to do it. However, we provided in this report a very pragmatic approach to implementing LIHEAP that's more in line with need at each, in each state over a 3 to 5 year period. So what was really interesting, though, is even the first year, even just increasing the amount of LIHEAP, $459 million in year one, which is a very small amount of the overall funding, would get you almost to parity with states.
Do you get the sense that we will get to, or maybe we're already there, at some kind of tipping point where enough of the country is routinely experiencing extreme heat that policymakers will realize, hey, look, we need to do something about this. Like, this is a situation that is no longer sustainable.
Well, that is my hope and what I work for every single day. You know, certainly one of the ways I think that the conversation needs to shift is to talk about heat. Yes, we should absolutely be concerned about the morbidity and mortality, who gets sick and who dies from heat. The moral argument there is unprecedented, right? But we also have to expand this table a bit. And we have to bring in, for example, the private sector. I mean, I remind people all the time, who is it that employs people in high heat occupations? That's largely the private sector. Who owns our energy systems? That's the private sector too. And, you know, our health systems, also the private sector. So there is an economic cost to heat that is borne throughout our society and across every sector. So it is critical, in my opinion, that we start talking about heat for what it truly is, which is a threat to the economic security of our communities, in addition to a threat to our health. And so I like to think of this as well-being, right? Well-being includes not just measurable health outcomes, but also social and economic well-being as well.
All right. That is Ashley Ward, Director of the Heat Policy Innovation Hub at Duke University. Ashley, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. For the past several weeks, Muslims all over the world have fasted from sunrise to sunset in observance of the holy month of Ramadan. It's a time for reflection and community, and each day ends with a late-night communal prayer. In some countries, cafes and restaurants are open late during Ramadan, but Muslim Americans don't typically get that luxury here in the U.S. But here in Metro Phoenix, some Muslim business owners have adapted their hours to accommodate nighttime cravings for food, drink, and community. The show's Fatima Gabir explains.
It's 7 p.m. on a Monday in early March. Almost every seat at Le Moon Cafe in Tempe is taken. Baristas are scrambling, students are working, friends are catching up, and a few kids running around. Rawan Abdulbari came to Le Moon this evening to break her fast and pray at the nearby mosque. She says Le Moon, which opened in January, is a good place for Muslims to gather.
I just love the community feeling, especially being from Phoenix or just being from Arizona in general. I feel like we're separated a lot.
According to the Arizona Muslim Alliance, there are about 100,000 Muslim people living in the state. Most live in Metro Phoenix. Anam Ghori grew up in Phoenix and graduated from ASU in May. For Ghori, the small community actually makes Ramadan more enjoyable.
So Ramadan in Phoenix has its own like unique vibe, I guess. It's not a bigger city like Chicago or Dearborn, LA, with like a bigger Muslim population. But since it's small, it's more tight-knit and like you see the same faces every day.
Le Moon is located just north of ASU's Tempe campus, next door to the Islamic Community Center. The building is painted lime green with an arched entrance like prominent buildings in the Middle East. The ceiling has 100-year-old vintage Persian rugs made by a Syrian weaver. The owner of Le Moon, Noor Abdullah, says she wants the cafe to be a communal space.
If you walk into the building and you walk a little bit to the right, it's like a dining room. Our goal for that room was to be a very comforting space. We compared it to being like a grandma's dining room.
Abdullah is a Palestinian Syrian American. She was born in Michigan but grew up in Arizona. Abdullah is a physical therapist, but she always knew she wanted to do something on the side. She had plans to start her own coffee cart. Then, in late 2024, the building next to the Tempe Mosque became available. Le Moon's current space had been home for 30 years to a Middle Eastern restaurant called Phoenicia.
My brother always went there. My parents used to take me here all the time. It was somewhere you go like after Friday prayer, and it holds a lot of memory. And I think it just means a lot to the community itself.
The proximity to the mosque is the main reason Le Moon is staying open 24/7 during Ramadan.
So we make sure that, you know, we heavily staff during the times. We do everything to make sure we get our drinks out as fast as possible. We communicated with our staff the urgency of getting drinks quickly because of the time restraints that come with Ramadan.
Abdullah is referring to the voluntary night prayer Muslims do during Ramadan. There are also set times to break fast or start fasting.
I feel like a lot of people have been searching for a space like this. It's definitely a much needed space. And I mean, you can see it just by walking in. You'll come in on like a Monday night and you'll just see a bunch of people just studying or hanging out or, you know, just getting work done.
Abdullah plans to host community events in the future. While the cafe won't stay open 24 hours after Ramadan, she says the mission of fostering community will remain. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Fatima Gabir.
Ramadan ends tomorrow evening. For decades, Daryl Davis has had two jobs. He's toured the world playing blues and rock and roll on the piano, but he's also a self-proclaimed race relations expert. He calls himself the Rock and Roll Race Reconciliator. Davis takes pride in doing what some would find unthinkable, sitting down for conversations with members of the Ku Klux Klan. Davis, who is black, says his talks with Klan members have led to dozens of them leaving the group. He travels the country giving talks about the experience of trying to make friends with people who have been taught to hate him, and he'll be at ASU tomorrow. Davis spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman, and they began with one of Davis's earliest interactions with a Klan member. It happened at a club called the Silver Dollar, one of white man approached Davis after a show and said he'd never seen a black man play Boogie Woogie on the piano.
So I guess, you know, he was not familiar with Little Richard or Fats Domino,
right,
who plays, you know, the same boogie style. So I just figured, you know, he was a little bit naive. I wasn't really thinking the Klan.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he told me that he was a Klan member, I was a little shocked and surprised. But it didn't freak me out to the point, you know, where I hopped up and ran away or hit him or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he saw something he'd never seen before, and it made him curious.
Right. It seems like it made you curious also.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed.
And curiosity about what exactly? About the potential of conversations like that?
No, I wasn't thinking in terms of that at that time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, when I first experienced racism, I was age 10.
Mm-hmm.
And some people threw rocks and bottles at me and soda pop cans during a Cub Scout parade in which I was the only black scout. And I did not understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the people didn't like the scouts or something. later on, because I had no experience with that.
Yeah.
At that age of 10, I formed a question in my mind, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Right.
So,
right,
you know, when I sat there with this Klansman, it didn't dawn on me right in the moment,
yeah,
that this is the person I need to talk to. It dawned on me a few years later. The answer to your question that's been plaguing you since the age of 10, mm-hmm, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? It fell right into your lap. You know, get back in contact with that guy.
Right. Well, and of course you did then go through that process of interviewing dozens of members of the Klan, and you did write a book called Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan. What did those conversations teach you about how they came to a place in their lives where they wanted to be a part of an organization like that?
Some want to belong to something. They feel that they have nobody that they can relate to. Others, they're automatically into it because my grandfather was in the Klan. My daddy,
right,
was in the Klan. I'm in the Klan. My kids are going to be in the Klan.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Or they move to an area that is like a Klan stronghold.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to do business in that area, you have to assimilate. You join the local country club, the local chamber of commerce, and the local KKK. Now, there's another avenue that gets you in there as well. Like, take, for example, some depressed areas, coal mining areas.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, most of your coal miners have been white.
Right.
And they go there right out of high school. And their families have been working in coal mines for generations and generations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these people are not racist. They're happy people. They're making good money. They're keeping their family fed and a roof over their head, paying their bills. But then some of these companies that own the coal mines, they see all these immigrants coming into the country, and they know that these people will work for less than half of what they're paying their white workers. And now these white workers are out of work. And so the Klan sees things like this, and they will go into one of those towns, whether it's Scranton, Pennsylvania, or Bluefield, West Virginia, and they'll say, you know, the blacks have the NAACP and the Jews have the ADL and nobody stands up for the white man but the Ku Klux Klan. You know, your job is not gone, but you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And why does that, you know, racial epithet towards a Hispanic person or something, mm-hmm, have your job?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guy who was never racist to begin with, he's thinking, well, you know, gee, you know, what do I have to lose? Give me an application. Sign me up.
Right.
Because the Klan tells you they will get your job back for you.
Right. Yeah. I thank you for laying that all out, Daryl. And I mean, I think of the Klan as an organization founded partly on fear, you know, fear,
yes,
of people who look different than white people. And what you're describing amongst the Klan members you spoke to is a different kind of fear. It's a fear of not belonging, a fear of losing safety and economic viability for their family, and that the Klan as an organization knows how to deploy racism in service of, you know, keeping its numbers up.
You know, any kind of propaganda to make people, you know, come join this organization. And I talk to these people all the time.
Right. Well, so do you have a prescribed way that you approach those conversations? Is there some rubric to it in your mind, or do you just kind of take it one person at a time and treat it as a conversation with an individual?
Well, I have a template. Like, for example, you would say, if I asked you, do you think we need better education for kids? You would say yes. Do you think we need to get drugs off the street? You would say yes. Well, so does this Klansman. So now you got something in common with somebody in the Klan.
So those are questions you would ask. You might ask a hypothetical member of the Klan, like, you know, would you agree with me that we need to do this? Would you agree with
yes,
me?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you say, you know, well, what can we do together?
So this is fascinating to me, Daryl, because, I mean, I can see how that unfolds in conversation. But you have also taken this to very interesting extremes. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you once loaned your band's tour bus to
yes.
the leader of the Klan. What was behind that?
Well, you know, he was very friendly with me. He had invited me to several of his rallies, gave me a lot of information. I interviewed him. Uh-huh. And he lives in another county, not my county, here in Maryland. And he says, hey, do you know any places down there in Montgomery County that rent, you know, buses? I said, why? What's going on? And he said that the place that used to rent him buses does not want to rent to him anymore because, he takes these buses to Klan rallies with
right.
his Klan.
Right.
And I said, well, why don't you just take my bus? He says, oh, I don't know what to say. I said, just say yes, you'll take it, and you'll have no problem. He goes, okay, well, how much do you want for it? I said, I don't want anything for it. Just put some gas in there, and we'll call it a day. And so he said, okay. And after the march was over, I invited them all to come back to my house. And I had about 15 of them here in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a good time, sat around talking and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, the leader, that was one of the things that also, a little while later, also contributed to his decision to quit.
Yeah.
As he began to see the light.
Right. And so am I right, Daryl, that your thought in moments like that is the more I can, in these interactions, just present myself as, in this case, it sounds like something like a friend, you know?
Well, let's look at it like this, okay? I don't subscribe to Klan ideology. And,
uh-huh.
you know, I'm not bending over, you know, kissing his rear end or anything like that.
Sure.
But, you know, my doing that for him put a whole different perspective in his mind. You know, this black guy lent me a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a cognitive dissonance with him.
And do you ever get pushback about this approach?
Sure.
Because, I mean, I know you must know this. There's a lot of people who feel like the proper way to deal with hate groups and hateful people is to not engage, to, you know, fight fire with fire, so to speak.
You know, there are those who understand what I'm doing and support me. And there are those who, you know, they don't get it at all. I'm a sellout. I'm an Uncle Tom. I'm an Oreo. I'm this, that, and the other. And again, that pushback is fear. Because, listen, this behavior, you're not born with this behavior. Nobody's born hating somebody. You know, that's acquired. It's learned.
Right.
And so what can be learned can be unlearned.
Well, I have been speaking with Daryl Davis, who is an internationally renowned touring musician and also a speaker on the issues we've been talking about today. He's also the author of the new book, The Klan Whisperer, one of several books he's written about this, and he will be at ASU on Thursday, March 19th. Daryl, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Listening to Daryl right now, by the way. And that'll do it for today's edition of the show. Thanks for joining us. We will, of course, be with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzzTheShow.